At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hey, John, it's Dave Douglas. I'm really, really angry that you sent me this music, and it's so outrageous. It's not at all what I expected. It's not really what we're looking for here at A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. So thanks, and talk to you soon, man. All right, later.
Listening there to the music of John Robigon, a great saxophone player and composer, and you're also listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates, and I'm here with trumpeter, composer Dave Douglas.
Hi, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Glad to hear it. Looking forward to talking to John.
Me too. Known him a long time.
Yeah, I know. And actually, it's funny because you're the first person that introduced me to his music before I knew who he was. You know, and then he wrote that tune that's called Camp Douglas, and I thought he was talking about Banff, but I don't think it had anything to do with the Banff workshop, so that was kind of fun. John, it's Dave Douglas calling from the Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
How you doing, Dave?
I'm okay. You know, I had a change of heart. We are interested in talking to you after all.
All right, great. Great, that's what I'm here for.
So, Michael Bates is on the line.
Hey, John.
Hey, Michael. How's it going?
Good, good, good.
Is this an okay time to talk?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So what do you want to talk about?
That's a very good question. The weather just got really nice here in New York, so we can talk about that for a while.
Yes, it did.
It's lovely. You know, you sent me this music, and I didn't know what to say. You know, it's not at all what I expected from you, and I'm kind of scandalized, to tell you the truth.
Okay, we can talk about that for a second.
Well, I don't mean to be putting you on the spot, but, you know, it's a little embarrassing, quite honestly.
Well, I just kind of dug up what I could send to you, but yeah, those are three tracks from my new record, Unhinged. It came out, like, at the end of last year. And
you expect people to buy this music?
I guess it's more of me having a need to get those thoughts and ideas out, and hopefully somehow along the line, somebody's going to buy the music and find a way to appreciate it.
Yeah, apparently not Dave Douglas.
Yeah.
I'm a tough customer, basically. But what label is that on, John?
I started my own label
right,
at the end of last year called Arabagast Records.
Jarabagizzle, did you say? Or
yeah. That's the alternate name, but yeah, it's Arabagast Records.
Great.
Well, you know, for the record, I really like that recording.
All right, I'll take it.
I don't care what Dave Douglas says. I think it's fantastic.
We need a tiebreaker then. Where's Jim Turk at?
Well, you can vote.
You could vote
if you want.
All right. Well, I kind of like it. So
cool. Unhinged.
Unhinged. Yes.
And it's like a cast of thousands, right? I mean, it's like the Cecil B. DeMille of jazz.
It's the record as a whole is mostly quintet, and it's got Jacob Sachs and John Hebert and Tom Rainey and Ralph Alessi. And a couple of the tracks have an extra person or two, and then the Silent Smile track that I sent you has about 30 extra of my good friends just blasting away along in the background.
Are you friends with Parker Posey, John Arabigan?
No, but I hope to be from that song.
You think that she's going to catch on with her peeps and she's going to call you and ask you to appear in the next Christopher Guest movie? Is that what's...
I mean, that would be... It'd be great for her to hear it and hear what she has to say about it, good or bad. I went through a period where I tried to watch every... I went to IMDb and looked up every Parker Posey movie and tried to watch them in succession as quickly as I could.
And how'd that go?
I watched a ton of them, and yeah. A bunch of them are really nice, and a bunch of them are not, you know, just fine. And I wrote that scene right after that. So
oh. The way Ralph is playing on the song Parker Posey is pretty amazing.
Right. Well, so I have some of the alternate takes of Parker Posey. Ralph is not playing like that at all. So.
Huh.
That's the take that happened to make it on there.
You'll have to really think carefully before you choose which take you want her to hear, because I don't, you know, who knows her taste in jazz trumpet solos.
Yeah.
I mean, Ralph Alessi, it's going to be great every time, but you know, it might be a matter of personal taste for her. I mean, again, it's like you think about it like doing something really familiar and finding a way to put all the players in a situation they've never been in before and draw something different out of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a part of it. And I mean, I know just from all their musicianships that they've gone through those kinds of things. And let's see, for example, at the beginning of Walt Disney's, it's an open piano solo for Jacob Sachs, mm-hmm. and he could do whatever he wanted. And I play that song in other situations where people will play these rhapsodic, like, huge piano cadenzas and things. And so on that particular take on Walt Disney's in the studio, he just plays this completely minimalist, pluralistic solo. I'm like, that is the perfect, I never would have thought of that, and it's the perfect compliment to whatever is about to happen next.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of that in and out, give and take kind of thing that they can choose to use the material, or I'm totally fine with them just blasting away in a completely opposite direction.
So, like, we're talking about the way that you handle all the other musicians in your group, but, like, you yourself as a player, you're somebody who plays a lot of different, you know, on the saxophone. You can go a million different directions, and you have all this language and different styles, not only different styles, but, you know, different even, you could, like, think of it like an actor, like, inhabiting different roles. So when you put the music together for your groups, do you think that you're trying to put together those same sorts of challenges for yourself? Or
Definitely. Like I was saying about Ralph, I think on some of the other takes of Parker Posey, I'll play in a completely different way also. I think for me, playing with musicians who have those options and seeing that process of them choosing, whether intentionally or not, which avenue to go down on a particular night or after so many gigs or even like just from the succession of tunes that you're playing on that gig, like just to see those options and them activating those options or not, like that's one of the most fun things for me getting to play with really high level improvisers.
Yeah. I mean, you when you joined my group, I wasn't aware of, you know, the sheer genius and supernatural nirvanic awareness that you bring to music. So I was humbled.
That's nice.
No.
I'll take it.
When you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is just that, you know, in on the projects that we've done together, we're also going to some other musical places. And I think the way I do it is different than the way you do it, which is as it should be. But, you know, you really stepped into some things, some personality roles that were interesting and not at all what I expected.
Sure, like, for example, I think it's the second tune on Be Still.
High on a Mountain.
Yeah.
Like John and Robigan.
Yeah, having to go to that kind of the bluegrass kind of saxophone. But and it's funny, the first time I heard that, I thought, wow, you know.
It's that, like he never that, left the trailer park.
Well...
Time is blotted out of memory. As my memory returns, oh, how my heart.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, playing in your group, Dave, yeah, I think that all this, all my kind of prep and it's just figuring out where I'm trying to come from with my music and with Outright Band and stuff like that, it definitely helped me come up with different ways to kind of approach your music and add different elements to it.
So like a few years ago, John, you won some big saxophone competition. You were like a big champion. It wasn't the Olympics.
It was the Jazz Olympics, yeah.
Was it the Oscar or you got an EGOT in saxophone?
A polyglot.
But what's interesting is, you know, what was it? Was the Monk competition, was
it
not?
Yes, it was the Thelonious Monk competition,
yes.
Dave.
I mean...
Yes, he was a piano player, yeah.
That's like major.
That was a big deal.
Like, I've heard of him. I guess what I want to get at is, like, that's an incredible honor, and the people that you're surrounded with there and the people who are the judges and the institute itself is this very, very, I would say important and astute organization.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
mm-hmm.
really a wise vision of... the legacy of Thelonious Monk and the tradition of that music and honoring it by honoring young players who come mm-hmm. along like yourself. And so having mm-hmm. won that and, you know, that means a certain familiarity with quote unquote straight ahead jazz playing.
Yeah.
And then you turn around and record Silent Smile with like 3,500 players and it's...
Right.
I don't know what my question is here, but would you care to elaborate?
How
do you feel about that? I mean, is that conscious?
The Monk, I guess the Monk competition thing was super important for me and a really fun time. I know jazz competitions are just kind of strange and maybe even against what people think about when they think of jazz and creative music, because how do you create a contest about creative music? So. It could be a stressful time too, because you're getting your art judged by five of the most important saxophone players in the world. So, I guess I went into it. Most importantly for me that weekend was to get to hang out with people like Wayne Shorter and Greg Osby and Jimmy Heath and David Sanchez and Gina Erblum, and get to just hang out with them for a few days and just pick their brain about stuff, or even just be around them.
Uh-huh.
That was really the most important part. And then like trying to have fun with the rhythm section. And,
yeah,
I picked some tunes that I could relax on, and it kind of worked. It just worked out that weekend, and so I'm super grateful for that. But you know, like Wayne Shorter was really supportive, and he had some, and he continues to have some very good, really inspiring and insightful things to say to me. So like that really was some of the most important aspects of that competition.
Do you have an example of that? Can you share any of those words of wisdom?
Well, Wayne's very cryptic. I saw him the next year after the Monk competition, and he remembered who I was, and I came up to him and I said hi, and he pointed at me, and he was looking at me, and he turned his feet like 90 degrees to the right, and he pointed at me, and he said, "You," I'm like, "Okay," he said, "You have to go," and then he turned his entire body where his feet were facing. Your own way. And then he pointed to the right, you know, and then he just walked off.
Nice.
And so And so, I mean, you can, someone can interpret whatever they want out of that. But for me, like, he had been kind of, I was kind of telling him what I was doing at the time. I was kind of filling him in on where I was coming from and what I was, what kind of, like, issues I was having, just trying to figure out what to do, because, yeah, I love playing straight ahead jazz, but I have this aspect of me that wants to challenge the improvisers to deal with genres on their own terms and then also try to combine them and take them away. So I was trying to explain some of that to him, and that was what he came up with. So I'm like, wow, if Wayne Shorter is telling me to just do whatever I feel is in my heart, then that's the way I'm going to go.
When you won that competition, I remember having conversations with a lot of our friends, and we were all so thrilled because you're the perfect ambassador for so many aspects of creative music and jazz and improvised music and the whole panorama of what we all try to do.
Right. Well, thanks. I actually did, around that time period, I was thinking about this a lot because, you know, I went to school at Manhattan School of Music. That was kind of my gateway into New York. I got a master's there, and then I did 2 years at the Juilliard School. Right after that, I got an artist diploma there because I didn't have any connections in New York. I didn't know anyone. I wasn't playing any gigs, and I didn't want to start paying my student loans back. So there was an opening at Juilliard, so I decided to go there. And so it was interesting to get to do 2 years with Dave Liebman and Dick Oates, and then 2 years with, like, Wynton Marsalis and his crew and Victor Goins and stuff. So they kind of have different ways of looking at jazz, I'd say. And so it was interesting to be in the middle of all that, but also know that for myself, I had this, you know, like the beginnings of the outright bands that recorded on him, and those tunes and that kind of concept of writing tunes in that way. That was already bubbling up. And so I realized that for me, at least just for myself, that I needed to really learn the tradition and the history of tenor saxophone and alto saxophone and soprano saxophone, and really, really delve into that and study it in earnest in order for me to be able to get whatever my ideas were across, because my ideas depended on these very genre-specific things.
Sure.
So it was kind of a complex web of things I had to deal with.
So that was the plan from the get-go?
I guess I couldn't really articulate it at that time, but now that I'm looking back on the last bunch of years, it just seems like it all was leading that way, and I had to make proactive choices to make that kind of thing possible.
Wow.
Well, thanks for speaking to us today.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure.
It's been great hearing about the music. And I will see you on the bandstand, my friend.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I can't wait. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Thanks to John Arabican. That was a great conversation, great music.
Absolutely.
Hilarious guy.
Yes.
Okay, so Michael wants to talk about vinyl, which I'm also very eager to talk about.
Yeah.
Vinyl, that is not just the alloy, but the record.
My wife gave me a turntable for Christmas, and it's been a long time. I mean, I'm old enough to have been collecting vinyl in my early teens until my middle teens, and then, you know, I haven't had a turntable for years and years and years. And I knew that if I did get back into it, it would be a slippery slope. And I think since December 25th, I'm now up to about 70 records, new records that I've bought. Well, not brand new records, but. Mm-hmm. And it's been a lot of fun. I mean, New York is, you know, we have no major record stores anymore in the city, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of great little stores. And so I've been going through the dollar bins at Academy Records in Midtown and a couple of, and there are a bunch of places in Greenpoint. And not just the dollar bins, I've also been, you know, picking up just stuff that means a lot. But for me to sit down in the morning and listen to 22 minutes is a great way to start the day. And
people say 22 minutes is the correct amount of
it seems about right
to get up and flip the record.
Yeah. And it has just really changed my relationship to listening and being a fan again in a very different way. So it's kind of cool. I recommend it.
Well, we're doing vinyl at Greenleaf now, and it sounds great, and it's, you know, more and more it seems people are interested in it. And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have an opinion about vinyl if you don't have a turntable of your own. And I think that's such a cool thing. I saw you the other day, or no, maybe it was Jim Turk who found an additional an original print of Wayne Shorter's Schizophrenia.
At a
record store, and, you know, maybe. Of course, put it right up on Instagram, and the news travels
and
fast.
And, well, it's funny, because we both went to the Wayne Shorter show at Carnegie Hall, and we ran into each other, and I had just come from Academy, and where I had found literally maybe 10 or 12 Wayne Shorter records, which I all own. I own on CD, but I was so excited to have them, and I have an original pressing of ESP, the Miles Davis Quintet record, and it's exciting. I don't know why, but fun.
There's a friend of mine in Germany named Rainer Harman who used to be the artistic director at Jazz Baltica in Salzau, and he's now started a vinyl-only label called Edition Long Play. And he just sent me these 180 gram audiophile pressings, and it's artists like Edmar Castaneda and Joe Locke and Kate McGarry, Theo Bleckman, and it's really, really interesting. The artwork is beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's great to see him doing it. You know, Be Still, my record, was on vinyl, and we're looking to do another vinyl record.
I happen to own the vinyl copy.
Good. Okay, that was the signal that we were supposed to move on.
I think it was.
That was enough of that vinyl. So I just want to talk very briefly about Booker Little. I just recently was doing a reading of the music from my record In Our Lifetime, which was dedicated to Booker Little, and I realized that a lot of the people hadn't really heard Booker Little, and, you know, he's been a huge influence on me, his music, from the late 50s, early 60s. And actually, I found out from talking to Kenny Wheeler that, you know, back in the day, Kenny had the same experience of hearing Booker Little's music and having it open him up to a new way.
It's incredible
working.
Stuff. I mean, the forms, the way he was dealing with rubato sections, and, you know, I heard your music, doing the music of your records, doing the music of Booker Little before I heard Booker Little, and it was very shocking, you know.
Yeah, he's you know, somebody that boy,
he was 23.
He could have lived longer. Yeah,
23.
Yeah.
Man.
But Out Front is a record that I highly recommend, and maybe we'll play a little excerpt from there. At one point, I did a sort of a study. I transcribed a bunch of his music, and there's an essay I wrote about his use of half steps in his voicing.
It's in the Arcana book.
It's in one of the Arcana.
Volume 4, if I'm not mistaken. The Zorn Arcana.
So that's something to check out. But Booker Little, definitely... you know, a huge voice in the music that's worth looking into.
Yeah, let's listen to some.
Thank you.
So that was Booker Little, and you are listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast with Dave Douglas and me, Michael Bates.
And we occasionally talk about special venues that we have liked. And so there's a few events that are coming up, and one of them is the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, and I will be there.
Where is that?
It's in the UK. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting festival because there's all sorts of music, experimental and more traditional, and, oh, let's say jazz that brings in other sorts of languages.
Right.
And I just love the people there. And I've been there a few times, and so I'm going there with the Be Still project with a Fantastic. Wonderful vocalist named Heather Moss. And I'll also be on a panel with Dave Stapleton from Edition Records talking about artist-run labels and things like that. So that should be a wonderful time. And then the other festival I wanted to just briefly mention is the Vancouver Jazz Festival, which had a huge role in my own development.
And certainly mine as well.
You're from Vancouver originally.
I'm from Vancouver. I used to volunteer with that festival from the age of about 16 years old and onward. Wow. The director of that festival, Ken Pickering, has been a champion.
Not a very nice guy, though.
Not a nice guy.
No.
Don't
no.
like Ken.
Yeah.
he's been a big champion for me, and I in a lot of ways, I think for you too, you know, has
Absolutely.
Presented
yeah.
Your music. And he's a real visionary in terms of who he would bring over. I mean, I heard Han Bennick and the Clissoni Trio and a lot of European Dutch improvisers there growing up. And I mean, it was an incredible experience that I didn't know was really all that significant until I left and realized that that was a singular festival in a lot of ways, certainly for Canada.
And I heard Terrence Blanchard, who I had never heard, you know, when I went to play, and then I heard Terrence, and you know, just that it was that open and all these things could coexist.
Yeah.
And that Ken and the you know, a lot of people at the festival, I think, you know, it's obviously a big organization of people coming together. But I guess my point is they created the audience for that music in Vancouver by presenting all of these things in juxtaposition, and that's just so inspiring. So
great
that
festival.
Is my shout out. And this was our edition of A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.